It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it's the anniversary of the Charlie Hebdo attack in Paris. We'll look at the legal approach France is taking to terrorism prevention and whether or not it's working.
First, Governor Walker says he'd like to see Wisconsin's Attorney General to take any and all legal measures available to challenge President Barack Obama's recent executive action on gun sales.
The governor's comments were issued in a press release yesterday, just a day after the president issued a number of executive orders during an emotional speech on Tuesday.
The president will address the American people directly tonight in a televised town hall meeting called Guns in America on CNN live at 7 p.m. tonight.
Joining us now to discuss the president's actions and the move by Governor Walker is Howard Schwaber. He's a political science professor at UW-Madison. Howard, welcome back to the show.
Nice to be here.
Let's look at possible legal lines of attack against the president's executive actions. And the one a lot of people are paying attention to is the one that would expand background checks. One possible challenge, the idea that this violates the Second Amendment, and that's something that maybe a state like Wisconsin could challenge. How would you see that playing out?
Right. So there are really two basic possible challenges here. One, as you say, is that the order, violates the Second Amendment. And the other is that the order doesn't violate the Second Amendment, but it exceeded the president's authority. So two different ways of calling this into question. Let's start with the Second Amendment one. All the federal courts and the U.S. Supreme Court have repeatedly told us that the individual right to bear arms is subject to reasonable regulation. And no one has suggested, I shouldn't say no one, but no court has suggested that background checks in and of themselves are unreasonable and a violation of the Second Amendment. So the idea that extending background checks to a broader range of categories of gun sales would somehow violate that standard seems very hard to support. We always, you know, particularly given the history of the last 10 or 15 years at the Supreme Court, we always have to be on the lookout for surprising new doctrines that we didn't see coming. But it is difficult for me to see how, if background checks are consistent with the Second Amendment in general, how extending them to gun shows or other people engaged in these transactions, how that would somehow become unconstitutional. So I think that's a weak argument. The other problem there is that the state doesn't really have standing to bring it. States don't have constitutional rights. Individuals have constitutional rights. Some individual who's threatened with a prosecution or a fine, that person could have standing to challenge this in court and say, hey, this violates my constitutional rights. But it's very difficult for me to see how the state of Wisconsin gets that standing.
Right. And Howard, before we move on to the other avenue of attack with this Second Amendment issue, I mean, the administration is arguing that, hey, we already have the authority. We already have the directive from Congress in the way the federal government enforces background checks. We're just we're modifying how that's being executed as the executive branch here. Do you think that argument would hold up?
Right. So that gets to the second question. Did this order exceed the president's authority, right? Whether it's constitutional or not, does it exceed the authority granted by Congress? So the law written by Congress is very vague. It permits the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms to impose background checks on people engaged in the business of dealing in guns. The problem is Congress left that term utterly undefined and very, very vague. If you want to think of two sort of ends of the spectrum, one is someone who has a brick-and-mortar gun store and is regularly in the business of selling guns. That person is clearly in the business of selling firearms. The other is, you know, if I want to sell my brother-in-law my shotgun, that doesn't put me in the business of selling guns. But there's a lot of middle ground there, and no clarity at all in the statutory language from Congress as to where the middle ground falls. What if I sell one gun a month, every month for 10 years? Or some other combination of things. What if I run a business out of my basement but don't have a separate store for it? And, of course, gun shows. So as long as Congress leaves those terms that vague, it has been traditionally understood, and courts have repeatedly stated, that it is indeed up to the law enforcement branch, the executive branch, to determine the meaning of those terms and decide how these things will be enforced. This is much less complicated, for example, than a year ago when Obama made the orders about immigration and enforcement immigration law. There, the executive orders that Obama created did multiple things, including not only establishing certain discretion in the enforcement of the law, but also distribution of benefits and a lot of other things. That was a really complicated set of rules that arguably altered or even contravened the law as it existed. Arguably, I say it's before the courts right now. This one is much simpler. Congress left this very, very vague, and when the legislature leaves law enforcement terms vague, it's up to law enforcement to determine what they mean. It's a little bit like when Wyoming and Montana, I think, experimented with not having speed limits. that instead said police can stop you if you're driving in a way they think is unreasonable. If you write a rule that vague, then you're leaving it to the cops, in this case the ATF, to determine what the rule means. The other point there is that, of course, Congress could change this tomorrow. Congress absolutely has the power to clarify that rule, and if Congress were to do so, the president would not have the authority to alter those rules by executive order. So all of this is taking place against a curious combination of a legal giant empty spot that Congress has deliberately left and a political highly contested issue. This gives the ability for both sides to scream foul on political grounds without any necessary real strong legal analysis behind it.
Talking to Howard Schwaber, political science professor at UW-Madison, about the Obama administration's actions on gun control, the executive action on gun control earlier this week. Governor Walker asking the state's attorney general to review that, see if there are avenues for legal challenge from Wisconsin. On that wider issue of states challenging the federal government, I mean, there have been arguments over legal power between states and the federal government, I know, probably since day one. Has this gotten more common, especially where executive action are concerned in the Obama administration?
Well, it's gotten more common in the last, 15 years or so, or maybe 20 years by now, because of a very conscious and successful effort to train cadres of conservative lawyers to bring federalist challenges to federal authority to try and roll back some of the expansion of federal authority that we saw in the 60s and 70s and 80s. That's not surprising. In this case, though, I have not, at least so far, heard anyone suggest that the ATF is unconstitutional or that the federal law in general is unconstitutional. And as I say, whether it's on federalism grounds or Second Amendment grounds, if you want to challenge the constitutionality of the executive order, it would seem to me you'd have to challenge the constitutionality of the entire law. That is, if the federal government is intruding on state prerogatives by requiring background checks for firearm sales, that's true regardless of whether it takes place in a store or at a gun show or in my basement. You know, that distinction doesn't seem to make a big difference for federalism purposes, except insofar as you can make a sort of a Commerce Clause argument that says the sale of the gun from my basement doesn't affect commerce enough to fall within federal authority. So the answer is there is room for a challenge, but until there are actual cases and people who've been directly affected by the application of this executive order, it's difficult to see how that challenge will be made concrete.
So with the immigration law, states had more standing, it sounds like. States were more directly affected in terms of providing benefits, that sort of thing. In this case, it sounds like you're saying it's more likely that some gun seller who's required under this new executive action to get a federal firearm license, they would be the one who would be more likely to have a case that would move up through the courts.
Absolutely. The rules provide quite draconian penalties, fines of $250,000. For engaging in the business of selling guns without conducting the proper background checks. Someone gets hit with that fine, that person absolutely has standing to challenge us on all the grounds that we've been talking about. By comparison, the immigration order or the challenge to the Affordable Care Act, those are instances where states could say, look, this federal government action is imposing costs on us, forcing us to spend money in ways that we don't want to spend money, or interfering with our ability to pursue policies that we want to pursue. That's what gives us standing. In this case, it's just a straight regulatory authority question. Does the federal government have the authority to regulate this particular activity? And the difficulty with Governor Walker's position, or implied position here, I take it, that this violates federalism is that that argument should apply just as well to the entirety of the federal law, not just to these executive orders. Unless you can make a distinction on cases, and that's the sort of the distinction that would be raised when a particular person is hit with a fine and says, no, regulating my activities goes too far.
Well, we'll watch for that to happen. Howard, thanks a lot for joining us today.
I think it's guaranteed that will happen. Okay. Thank you for having me.
That's Howard Schwaber, political science professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, talking about a possible challenge by Wisconsin's attorney general to President Barack Obama's recent executive action on gun sales. Today's the anniversary of last year's terrorist attacks against Paris magazine Charlie Hebdo. Since those attacks, worries of Islamic extremist terrorism have only risen, with over 150 people killed in Paris in November and 14 in the San Bernardino shooting here in the U.S.
The debate rages on over how to confront extremists who could do harm, whether from Iraq and Syria or in the United States and Europe. And some critics say that measures taken to fight terrorism actually breed further extremism.
That's one criticism of French anti-terror efforts, which include prosecutions of people who are suspected of planning terrorist attacks or associating with the people who planned them. One of those imprisoned suspects is actually thought to have helped plan the Charlie Hebdo attack from behind bars.
Scott Sayer joins us now. He's a Paris-based journalist, and his Harper's January cover article is called "The Ultimate Terrorist Factory: Are French Prisons Incubating Extremism?" Scott, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you.
Two of the men involved in the Paris attacks of January last year were in close contact with the man who was in prison for being involved with a terrorist network. Tell us about that man.
That man's name is Jamel Begal, and Begal is an Algerian citizen who was actually French at the time that he was first imprisoned and stripped of his French nationality. He had been in Afghanistan around the turn of the century and was imprisoned shortly before 9/11 for what was then alleged to be a plot to attack the American embassy in Paris. And it was while he was in prison, pending trial and afterwards for that case, that he came into contact with two of the three men involved in the Charlie Hebdo attacks.
And you've communicated with him through a series of letters. And what does he have to say about his involvement in the Charlie Hebdo attacks?
Begal denies quite fervently that he was in any way involved in the Charlie Hebdo attacks, except to say that yes, he was a friend to two of the men involved. Begal, in fact, says the same of the alleged embassy plot. He's a man who's been charged twice in separate cases on terror charges, but the evidence to prove that he has actually been involved in any sort of concrete plot for violence has always been quite weak, and he has a lot of criticism to level against the system that has taken that evidence just the same and used it to convict him.
So he's been convicted twice. With that in mind, what has been the legal evidence or the legal case for sending him to prison, even though he himself never actually committed an attack?
The French have a very particular judicial tool that they like to use in terror cases such as this, which is called association de malfaiteurs, which basically means loosely a criminal association. In this case, in the realm of terror specifically. And essentially what the law allows is for authorities to target people who, speak to one another, which is to say either meet in person or speak by the phone, or are known to sort of be associates of one another, and two, who share an ideology that is deemed to be dangerous. And there's no question that Begal is a jihadist in the sense that he believes in the legitimacy of armed struggle in order to promote his version of Islam. And there's also no question that he associated with other people of like mind. And so effectively twice he's been charged and sentenced to 10 years in prison for thinking what he thinks and speaking with people who agree with him.
How would you compare the French legal approach of criminal association to the approach that we use here in the United States?
The problems have tended to be quite different. The French, since at least the mid-1990s, and really in some ways the mid-1980s, have been confronted with domestic terrorism, which is to say French people committing terrorism on French soil. The American experience of jihadist terror, in any case, has tended to be foreigners coming to the United States, if we take the case of 9/11, or fighting in foreign lands against American forces. So the Americans, both by choice and simply by convenience, have essentially gone after terrorists, alleged terrorists, as enemy combatants. It's been extrajudicial. It's involved the use of Guantanamo and torture and has received the criticism that it's received. The French have taken a judicial approach essentially since the beginning, which is to say they decided to deal with terrorism much as they would deal with any other criminal problem within the courts. The issue is that they've done it by creating a sort of exception to general law in order to treat specifically terrorism. And we've seen within that a certain amount of excess, not unlike the sort of excesses we've seen in the American approach to terror.
We're talking to Scott Sayer right now. He wrote the Harper's January cover article called The Ultimate Terrorist Factory, Are French Prisons Incubating Terrorism? And we're talking about this today on the one-year anniversary of the French attacks on Charlie Hebdo. And in this piece, you ask whether or not imprisoning people who associate with people planning terrorist attacks could actually incubate or further breed more terrorists. What did you find?
That's right. I think, quite frankly, the question about whether prisons may contribute to potential terrorism or even terrorism in France has been answered, and the answer is yes. There's been some recognition that that French prisons are sort of breeding ground, or at least a place where susceptible people are placed in contact with other people who are likely to attempt to recruit them, to convert them to their cause. And there's no question that we've seen a lot of that in the prisons right now in France. There's about 200 men who are considered Islamist radicals. Another 2,000 who are considered, 200 men who are considered Islamist radicals who are actually there on terror charges. Another 2,000 men who are considered Islamist radicals, and another 8,000 or so who are considered at risk of becoming radicalized. So there's no question that there's an issue. What Charlie Hebdo did last year was to sort of show the circle closing, which is to say, here we had a case of a man, Jamel Begal, in prison, who came in contact with these two men, appears to have radicalized them or pushed them further. To radicalize is a term that some take issue with. But here we see these men who, in prison, went deeper into their jihadist ideology or took it up in the first place, actually committing acts of terror. So here we sort of see the blowback from 20 years or so of French counter-terror efforts.
Can you talk a little bit about what it's like in the French prisons for some of the Islamists who are imprisoned there on suspicion of terrorism?
It depends. There are quite a lot of them, and have been quite a lot of them over the course of the past 20 years. The French who respect the European Convention on Human Rights are somewhat more parsimonious with their use of solitary confinement than we are in the United States. But quite often, these men are placed in solitary just the same, for lengthy periods of time. Sometimes they're brought out, but often they're confined in solitary. The problem, and this was the case with Begal, the man that I wrote about, the problem is that solitary is actually not solitary, which is to say, you're in a cell alone. You're not supposed to have contact with anyone else. But quite often, as it happens, you're able to have contact. And Begal, we know, was in contact with these two men, the two Charlie Hebdo and kosher grocery killers, presumably through the windows of his cell. And that's quite often the way that it works. The other reality that has to be taken into account in French prisons is that, by some estimates, as much as 60% of the population in prisons is Muslim. That doesn't mean that 60% of the population is there because they have committed some crime somehow linked to Islam. But they are culturally Muslim, and often not educated, often poor, and essentially they're ripe for recruitment by the men who are there on terror charges, and that's in fact what happened in the case of one of the men involved in Charlie Hebdo attacks, but with such a large population at risk. The problem is much larger than it might otherwise be.
You said that France takes this looking ahead, criminal association, legal approach to fighting terrorism because they've been combating on French soil for quite a while. But how is it going over in France now? Is it seen as an effective approach?
At the beginning, it was seen as an effective approach. There's no question. This law, Association de Malfaiteurs, was passed in 1996. And between 1996 and 2012, there was not a single successful terrorist attack, a fatal terrorist attack in France. And that came off the heels of several years in the early 1990s, where there were several successful terrorist attacks, both in France and against French interests, particularly in Algeria. So for about 20 years, it appears to have been successful. In 2012, there was a major terrorist attack in the south of France, in Toulouse and Montauban, by young men in Mohammed Mera, and since then there have been several more, including, of course, the Charlie Hebdo attacks and the most recent attacks this past November. There's a sense that, things are not working as they should. That being said, there has, as of yet, been very little taste for introspection and for a real analysis of the effects of the system in place. And so, in fact, the efforts of the government of François Hollande, the president, over the course of about the past 2 years since his election, have been to reinforce the law that already exists, to in fact expand it, in addition to expanding intelligence gathering operations and legalizing certain intelligence gathering techniques that had been apparently used up until then, but not used legally. And I'd say it's not a moment of, mm-hmm. of great introspection, unfortunately. It's rather a moment of retrenchment.
Scott, thank you so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
That was Scott Sayer. He wrote the Harper's January cover article called "The Ultimate Terrorist Factory: Are French Prisons Incubating Extremism?" I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferrett. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.
Tap your heels together 3 times and think to yourself, there's no place like home. There's no place like home.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferrett. There's no place like home for Dorothy and the Wizard of Oz, though it takes a long journey to figure that out. In a new book, our next guest says Dorothy is not alone. The concept of home is built into our brains. It's a big part of what makes us human. And it took us as a species a long journey to develop that attachment to home.
He says we can learn a lot about ourselves by looking at what home means to us and by paying more attention to the impact of homesickness and homelessness.
John S. Allen joins us now. He's a neuroanthropologist and research scientist at the University of Southern California, research associate in the Indiana University Department of Anthropology, and he's the author of the new book, Home, How Habitat Made Us Human. John, thanks a lot for joining us today.
No problem.
Well, I'm sure we could all think of the physical benefits of having shelter and maybe some nostalgia we associate with a house, but what does the concept of home look like to our brains?
Well, it's about feelings, really. When we say, and I really started working on this when I thought, what does it mean to say you feel at home? And these feelings that we have that are associated with home are not the great big emotions, you know, superlative joy or happiness or strong grief or sadness, at least when you have your home, but they're in the background, the comfort, security, the expectation that you'll be able to rest and recover from the world. And so I think that we build on those feelings which developed over millions and millions of years of evolution, combined with our sort of cultural propensity to build things and make stuff and to be organized into large groups and to, associate with others in a place, and all that comes home, emerges from all that stuff sort of mixing together.
And this is non-trivial. Emotions, we're learning as you write, emotions like this one, our attachment to home, they're a key part of how our brains work, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, without emotions, people think of emotion, often separate emotions as the sort of irrational side of you, and decision-making as this rational side, sort of Kirk and Spock-like, or a Star Trek reference.
Mm-hmm.
But really, emotions are essential to decision-making, to taking actions or not taking actions, and whether they're fully thought out. You know, we can have sort of below the conscious level that kind of reaction, but also even at a conscious level, it's an artificial separation really between emotion and rational thinking, between mind and body ultimately.
Well, there's one feeling, one emotion that you say we've really unfairly taken for granted, looked down on in the United States recently. Hasn't always been that way, and that's the feeling of homesickness. Why should we take homesickness more seriously?
Well, homesickness is telling you something, right? It's saying if you're separated from this place, this special place that you've developed a relationship with, and, of course, relationship with the others who may be in that same place, but just taking the place, that when it's gone, it causes a negative feeling. And some people have said it's akin to a mini grief. And we think of grief as coming in when you lose a significant person. But this mini grief of homesickness can be quite, for some people, quite debilitating, or it, at least in the short term. And one of the things that we clearly have in terms of our flexibility, our behavioral adaptability, is that if you've grown up in a sort of a home building environment, you have the ability to make your home again. So we are flexible enough to do that, but it may take some time, and we have to get over that loss. And I think homesickness is really just telling us home's important.
And you note that once upon a time in American culture, when we were a nation mostly of immigrants, people who came across an ocean maybe to get here, or people who would up stakes and go, I don't know, to the California gold rush or something, we talked about a homesickness. We wrote about it. It was a shared experience almost. Now we see it as a sign of weakness.
Yeah, I think they were sort of that homesickness in that sort of huge migrant way where you really were, you'd go and you'd never feel, you'd never come back. Communication was very limited. You put everything behind them, could be very devastating, and that was actually called nostalgia. But over time, that term kind of moved toward this sense of longing for a gone time or place that isn't really associated with homesickness in a personal way. But today, you know, when we expect, we sort of equate geographic mobility with upward mobility, and so you're supposed to be able to get out there and move. And you know, that's not as important as necessarily as moving up. Now, a lot of people don't move very far from where they're from, but in this upwardly mobile sort of sense of the American dream, really, or fulfilling it, you know, you put away the fact that you're leaving something behind.
Talking to John Allen, he's the author of the new book, Home, How Habitat Made Us Human. Well, John, why did our brains evolve to have this strong concept of home, this strong relationship with some kind of home base?
Well, I think it's sort of, and this gets back, this is sort of in the middle of my book, but if you start in the middle sometimes, you see how I went one way or the other. And in the middle of the book, I talk about, say, in the evolution, our human evolution, as a highly social species, as a species that's having children who have very large brains, and very large brains take a long time to grow up and to train. Not only that, part of what made us a different kind of ape, besides walking around on two legs at that time, 2 or 3 million years ago, was that we were likely having more than one child at a time, and chimps and gorillas do not. They have one at a time. And to do that, to train this large-brained child with maybe a sibling around as well, that relied on larger social groups, and partly was bringing fathers into the equation, not necessarily the direct Ozzie and Harriet sort of way of, hey, Dad, but that, you know, there's a sort of introduction of their support to raising these offspring, and then even broader than that, a social environment. And then on top of all that, related to it is sharing of food, and hunting, and also cooking of food, some people would say. So all these activities, which are feeding this sort of basic humanity, which in an anthropological or zoological sense is being an ape that walks on two legs with a big brain, all that's enhanced by having a place. And that place has been called a home base by archaeologists, but we could basically just call it home.
I think of some of our human ancestors, some fairly recent ones in the scope of evolution, as being wanderers, hunters and gatherers who go
sure.
from place to place. Were they still, even though they were kind of on the move, were they still establishing these home bases that evolved into what we might think of as a home?
Well, as far as we can tell, I mean, partly is the archaeological record of these very flimsy structures that existed any time, but you know, before 20,000 years ago. Is very hard to interpret. One of the things that we do have is cave occupations, and our very close cousins, Neanderthals, clearly occupied caves as living spaces, and they also and they've used them, you know, on and off basis. So clearly, you can take with you home. Home doesn't mean being nailed to a certain spot, but it is going and establishing this sort of place. From which to operate and from which to recover and, you know, and from which to make plans.
In modern American culture, a home's usually thought of as a house, the ideal being the American dream, the house that we own ourselves. Do you think we've developed too narrow of a vision, a concept of the meaning of home?
Well, I think so. I mean, in the book, I talk about looking at just some other animals. I talk about these organ pipe wasps, and we have them around my house here. And you know, they make these mud nests that are on the wall, so they look like, if enough of them get together, it's kind of annoying. But they cover the wall with these organ pipes, and that's really a narrow view. If your species is named after the thing you live in, then that's really a tight bound. And we're not called, you know, two-bedroom apartment apes. We have a wide variety of things that we live in, and we can call home dwellings and domiciles or whatever you want to say. And that's why I sort of talk about in the book that I'm really interested in it from the inside out. I think if we look at it from within our brains and behavior, our psychology, you get a different view of what home is as opposed to just it being a house.
Yeah, you cite a culture, Aboriginal culture in Australia, as their house is the desert, in effect, and they look at a European-style house and think that's a jail. That's basically a cage you've built for yourself. So it doesn't necessarily have to be a human-made structure.
No. I mean, it's a structure that they've built. There's a cognitive structure, right? They've built that environment is transformed in their heads into something that is a domestic space, right? If we separate it from wild and domestic, they control that space in a way that other cultures wouldn't.
So what I guess I'm hearing is we've got this genetic predisposition, this genetic desire, demand, really, to have a home space that our brain treats as a home, and then we learn in our culture what that is, what that's going to look like, what we have to do to build it.
Right, and I mean, it doesn't even have to be as strongly genetic that, but we are cultural, and we have these feelings, we have these tendencies, and together all that kind of builds up into what we call sometimes a biocultural adaptation. I think it is very strong, these feelings that add up to feeling at home work together as a very adaptive thing for us as a species and for our ancestors, too.
Talking to John Allen, his new book is Home, How Habitat Made Us Human.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234 with your questions and your experiences. What does home mean to you? Do you feel attached to your current house or apartment, or maybe the one that you grew up in is home? Have you experienced homesickness in your life, and how did it hit you? Call 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We continue our conversation now with John Allen. He's a neuroanthropologist and author of the new book, Home, How Habitat Made Us Human.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of when you think of home? Is it a building? Is it the people? Is it the memories? Have you ever been homesick or homeless? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go right to a caller. Ivy is on the line with us in Evansville. Ivy, hi.
Hi. I think of having a home as extremely adaptive, not just for humans, but for other animals, for wildlife. For example, if you were plopped in the middle of a city and you had to find food, it would take you a lot of time to find where you could, you know, shop or whatever. If you're living, our ancestors knew when things were available, there was a temporal aspect to it, and they knew where it was available. So if you have this place that you are familiar with, you can find food at different places and different times of the year, and you know where there's water, where it's safe. Maybe your dwelling is a place where you can sleep at night. And that's true for wildlife. I think they know where they're, for example, spotted owls know where their nest site is, and in the mating season, they get together, and it saves them time.
I want to jump in and get our guest's response. Thank you so much for that call,
yeah.
And she brings up a great point. But is there something different about the nests of wasps or the spotted owl's nest or the squirrel's nest that is somehow conceptually different from our nests, our homes?
Well, partly, yes. I mean, yes and no. I mean, yeah, those things, like, and I talk about prairie dogs in the book as well. Certainly, those are providing shelter. They're an important place in the environment. It's a fixed point for them. What's interesting, as primates, you know, apes and monkeys are sort of neighborhood of the zoological world. We don't find that though. That is, actually building a structure, a home, whatever you want to call it, is virtually unique amongst all primates, and only the very most primitive crow simians nest in a hole, put their babies in a hole, these sort of little, not lemur-like, lorises, those sorts. Some of those will do that because they're nocturnal, and so they kind of hide out during the day. But that's about it for a kind of structured, protected life for primates. And so we come from that background of really non-builders, non-burrowers, non-anything like that. And then we emerge from it as people who generally, in 99% of the time, seek some sort of shelter and build it themselves. And so that's what makes us other animals certainly have this sort of habit, but amongst primates, it reemerges in us sort of uniquely.
Ivy, thanks a lot for that call. We'll go next to Todd in Madison. Todd, hi.
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 To me, the concept of home is more of like an area.
Mm-hmm.
As I travel around the country, I feel like when I get back into the Midwest, when I see the rolling hills of the Driftless, even if I'm not back in my home in Madison, I feel more at home with a bigger environment. So I don't really consider home like a specific place, but sort of like more region. I feel more at home in the region.
Yeah. Todd, that's really interesting. Thanks for bringing that up. So it's a familiar landscape, a home landscape for him in a way.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's kind of feeding on the same sort of familiarity and comfort and security that you can extend both. That's why I say it's not necessarily limited to a house or an apartment or anything like that. It's a conceptual thing. Now, some people may have a more expansive view of home, and others may really find it, you know, home is this place, and home is this place with these people who are my family or my closest associates of some way. Might be your things, right? So I think there's flexibility in there, and that's part of why we see it's a core sort of cognitive package that can tolerate a lot of this individual and cultural variation.
Todd, thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to John Allen. His new book is Home, How Habitat Made Us Human. Before we get back to more callers, John, one thing you try to do, or you tease with some ideas of ways we could put this into practice, maybe in policy issues, maybe in our lives. And what I wanted to key in on was homelessness. Given that, you know, if you're a homeless person, you're probably dealing with economic issues, trying to get a job. You might be dealing with mental health or substance abuse issues. Without that psychological grounding, that security of that home base, it seems like these problems might be more difficult to solve. And providing that space might be plan A, the first step towards solving those problems.
Yeah, I think it's important for everyone. I mean, for the people who are in that position, who are dependent on society in the broadest sense to alleviate their homelessness, I think it's important for everyone else to understand just how serious that is, that to be without a home is just in some ways not to be part of the society, at least temporarily or permanently. One of the things, just as a sort of side thing, I was looking at reading the literature about stigma and brain imaging, so that in these sort of studies, they want to see what part of your brain lights up when you look at something that has a stigma or is disgusting or something. And just as an aside, they use homeless people as a stimulus for stigma or shame, just some of these studies. I mean, it just shows how that is so strong in our view that someone like that actually loses some of their humanity. And so I think it's really important for everyone else who's not in that position to recognize that it isn't just being without a roof over your head when it's raining, but it's taking a lot more from them than that.
We'll go back to our callers now. Terry is with us in Berlin. Terry, hi.
Hi.
Hello.
What I wanted to say was I think home is more people than a place.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a former military spouse. We moved our children 16 times.
Yep.
I viewed my job as making home for my family wherever we were.
Terry, thank you so much. So, John, even if you're not in the same place for a long time, we have apparently the capacity to create a new home.
Exactly. I think that's something you grow up in. And someone who works at that, you know, hard, that is trying to ensure that their family, despite these moves, is always maintaining a home feeling anyway, is doing a great service for their children when they're growing up. And we see the opposite of that, say, in children who get lost, you know, in a sort of revolving door foster care. And if they get stuck in that and age out of the system, never having really had a home, what you really are seeing later in life is an inability, probably an inability to actually build a home in a way that we all think of as productive. I mean, obviously you can learn, but it's really critical in this sort of younger age, developmentally, to understand and to learn to enjoy that feeling of home. And so I think that's exactly right. I think the relationships are one of the strongest things within a house, are one of the strongest things that define our feelings of home and their ability to reestablish that in a new place. The place, again, being less relevant than the relationships that it contains.
John, as we wrap up, what kind of lessons do you hope people take from what we know about our brains and our concept of home to improve our lives, to improve our relationship with our home, whatever that might look like?
Well, I think it's to get the essential relationships. And I think, you know, you see this tiny house movement, and then there's the whole tidy movement as well, people tidying, getting rid of the things that aren't important. And I think both of those sorts of things are sort of implicitly getting at the idea that, well, where you live, there's something else. There's something that's more important for being happy. There's something more important for making your home more useful for you. And if you get rid of extra space or extra things, maybe you can focus more on using the place of home for resting and restoring yourself, for thinking about how you're going to be when you're not at home. And so I do think those sorts of approaches, which may not be for everyone, certainly, are hinting at how we can make home better.
John, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's neuroanthropologist John Allen. His new book is called Home, How Habitat Makes Us Human. Hardcore lottery fans and casual players, too, are excited this week with the big multi-state Powerball jackpot going up over $700 million and counting.
No winner was picked in yesterday's drawing, so the jackpot rolls over into a drawing on Saturday night. Wisconsinites spent an estimated $2.8 million on Powerball tickets in the run-up to the drawing yesterday. Hopefully nobody started spending their winnings beforehand. Lottery officials estimate the chances of winning at 1 in 292.2 million.
I like those odds. I saw some comparisons in media reports on odds, chances of being bitten by a shark in your lifetime. It's more likely 1 in 264.1 million. I'm guessing it's a bit lower in Wisconsin, so if we stay here, we're safe. But chances of being struck by lightning, way more likely than winning the lottery, 1 in 3,000 in the average lifetime. So now I'm going to forget the lottery. I'm going to spend all night worrying about that.
Right. Those are some scary odds. I mean, the odds are not great for Powerball, and yet,
right,
on the other hand, it's enticing.
Right. The dream of having that much. Though, I don't know. I don't want to be a downer on this thing. You see reports sometimes that lottery winners... I am. I do. That lottery winners end up not being that happy with,
right,
that much money.
It does bring up a whole host of other troubles, but put that aside for a minute.
Right.
If you won, what would you do?
I'd go get another one of those chocolate chip cookies I had earlier today. I'd splurge, man. Two cookies.
And
you?
You'd buy one for everybody here at
WPR. For everybody at WPR, yeah. And the state. Chocolate,
yeah,
cookies for all.
for the next 10 years, apparently.
Yeah. Well, stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time on the Ideas Network.